Good afternoon. You are tuned to a Juno Afternoon here for Wednesday, the 27th of April, the year 2016. I'm Jeff Brown. I'll be your host for today. We'll be learning about the Juno Fine Arts Camp with guest Amy O'Neill Hawk. We'll talk with facilities manager John Cooper about how they take advantage of technology at the Tess Stevens Marine Research Institute. Bernard Corey, architect, will offer a preview of his Alaska Design Forum presentation tonight. And we'll get an update about kids' summer classes at the campus. We'll also learn about 4-inch casts and get an update from the City Museum. Well, the forecast for tonight, scattered rain showers in the evening, then rain likely later on. Forecast for Thursday, rain likely with high temperatures around 47 degrees. Friday, rain likely with high temperatures around 50 degrees.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. 10 people from across the country are being recognized today at the White House for their work to help those with a criminal record change their lives around. As KMBA's Jocelyn Estes reports, one of them is a Yupik man from Alaska.
Greg Razzo is in Washington, D.C. to accept a White House Champion of Change Award.
I'm proud to represent our state and Alaska Native people as we strive for equity and justice in the criminal justice system.
Razzo is vice chair of the Alaska Native Justice Center and chair of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, which recently issued a report saying Alaska's criminal justice system is costly and ineffective and needs an overhaul. Razzo says the main reasons 2 out of every 3 Alaskan prisoners end up back in prison is the lack of treatment for substance abuse and mental health issues and the need for vocational training.
None of those supports are in place for people coming back into society, reentering society. And it's that reentry function that must start at the very beginning when a person comes into prison. They must begin with a plan that will help them to be successful when they get out of prison.
Razzo says legislation making its way through the state legislature would fix 90% of the problems. I'm Jocelyn Estes.
The Oklahoma state lawmaker widely criticized for his remarks last week that many viewed as disparaging to Native Americans has apologized. As KGOU's Brian Hardzinski reports, State Representative Todd Russ said during a floor speech that Native Americans are predisposed to alcoholism.
Russ said in an email to the Indian Country Today media network his comments during debate on a bill to change Oklahoma's alcohol laws were based on outdated information. He said substance abuse has no preference when it comes to race, gender, ethnicity, religion, or socioeconomic status, and he described the toll alcohol abuse took on his own family. Russ's House district includes the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes. The Republican from the small town of Cordell called the area beautifully diverse and said he wants to make sure everyone is represented. Russ said he hopes his comments have opened a dialogue and will allow him to make more educated decisions in the legislative process. I'm Brian Hardzinski.
35 tribes across the country are being awarded federal funds to improve transportation safety on tribal lands. On Tuesday, U.S. Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox announced more than $8 million for projects. The Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa in North Dakota is among recipients. It will receive more than $600,000 to reconstruct more than 14 miles of road, which has surface cracking, narrow shoulders, and poor line of sight. 54 projects across the country will be funded. Legislation to increase tourism on tribal lands passed the U.S. Senate this week. U.S. Senator John Barrasso, chairman of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, praised the Senate's passage of the Native American Tourism and Improving Visitor Experience Act. Barrasso says expanding local tourism to include tribes is a great way for Americans to learn about Native culture, history, and traditions. The bill is intended to enhance and integrate Native American tourism into the national travel and tourism strategy and increase culturally appropriate Native American tourism opportunities, create jobs, and support economic development. It now goes to the House for consideration. 24 young Native women from Indigenous communities in the U.S. and Canada are competing for the title of Miss Indian World. The competition is taking place this week in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The contestants are showing their skills in areas such as public speaking, dance, and their own tribal cultural knowledge. Miss Indian World will serve as a role model representing Indigenous people during her year-long term. The crowning takes place at the Gathering of Nations powwow on Saturday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at nativenews.net. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned to KTOO News and KRNN FM in Juneau. First guest in the studio is Amy O'Neill Houck, here to talk about the Juneau Fine Arts Camp. Amy, thank you for coming down to the station.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
So, for people who never heard about the Fine Arts Camp, can you give us an overview, please?
Sure. Juneau Fine Arts Camp is a month-long camp, and it runs actually 4 consecutive weeks. Kids can sign up for 1 week, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, whatever they'd like to do. And they have a wide range of classes in all kinds of fine arts, from visual art to dance to music, theater, sculpture, anything you can imagine. The camp is designed for grades K through 6.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
It's great.
Where's it going to be held?
It's going to be at Juneau Douglas High School. We kind of take over the high school with some littler kids for the month of June.
And about how many campers do you have?
We have about 150 a week.
What's the cost?
Well, for a full day, which is available for grades 2 to 6, it's $190 for the week. And if you're just doing a half day, it's $114 for the morning. And anyone can do the half day or full, and the full day is available for grades 2 and up.
It must be fun putting together all these classes.
It's really great. I enjoy talking to all the artists in Juneau, the teaching artists, and working with them and finding new classes to offer. So, and there's just such amazing resources here. So we're always bringing back old favorites and getting new classes all the time.
Well, that's my next question. What kind of old favorites do you have and what kind of new classes?
One of the most popular classes ever at Juneau Fine Arts Camp is cooking. And cooking will be back this year.
What are you going to cook?
They make all sorts of things. They make food shaped like animals and, you know, really things out of peanut butter, things, very kid-friendly things, but also healthy options. It's just, it's basically everybody's favorite class.
And what are some of the new offerings?
Well, this year we have a class called Bucket Drumming that I'm pretty excited about. Sandy Fortier is teaching that. And we have a new class called Make a Zine, which is like, you know, creating your own underground publication with cut and paste, kind of the old-fashioned way. So that will be really cool. Ukulele is back. That's another very popular class.
How is it structured? How long is each class?
Each class is about 50 minutes, so there's a little bit of time in between for the kids to come and go. They all meet up and start in the auxiliary gym of the high school, and they all have each class has student assistants that bring the kids to and from their classes. And in between each class, they come back to the gym and kind of shift around and change to where they're going to go next. So, and then the other thing that I really enjoy about that is that the students' assistants themselves are actually getting experience both working with children and working with teaching artists. So those students, some of them it's their first job, some of them are really passionate about art, or they're just passionate about working with kids, and they get a really great experience of doing both.
How long has this been going on?
Almost 40 years.
It's pretty much fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great experience, and I've taught in the camp, and now this is my 3rd year as director, so I've enjoyed putting classes together and finding assistants to work, and now that I have a high schooler myself, I'm kind of a little more connected to those teenagers, and that's a lot of fun, too.
As a structure, do students have to go from one stream of classes, or do they get to pick and choose?
They get to select their curriculum themselves, yeah, based on what's available. And then, they can make changes if they need to. But because the classes are the same week to week, the students can actually have a huge amount of variety because they don't have to take the same class all month long.
Who are some of the instructors?
Well, we have Sandy Fortier. We have this year, for the first time, Owen Cruz and Liz Kent teaching ukulele. We have Corrine Conlon, who teaches a class called Nature's Sketchbook. And Janice Hurley is a dance teacher. So we have a really wide variety of teaching artists. We have a Speak and Slam, which is a great class. It's the Wishkanati folks. They come in and they teach slam poetry. So that is each week another board member from Wishkay comes in and teaches.
How do people register?
You can go online to junodance.org because Juno Fine Arts Camp is sponsored by Juno Dance Theater, and you can sign up there.
Sounds fascinating. What are the dates again, please?
The dates of camp are June 6th to July 1.
How could people?
And you can go online at junodance.org, or you can call the office at 463-5327.
All right, Amy Honk, thank you for coming by. Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
I don't think so. I look forward to seeing everybody at camp. Thanks, Jeff.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 27th of April, 2016. It's the birthday of the playwright August Wilson, born Pittsburgh, 1945, raised by his mother in the Hill District of Pittsburgh. Black mother, a white German baker who was his father. At the age of 15, dropped out of school, headed to the library, where he became a devoted reader while he supported himself with odd jobs and hung around diners, street corners, listening to stories. Moved to St. Paul in 1978. Friend got him a job writing educational pieces for a science museum, got a fellowship from the Playwright Center, and started writing plays. First play was Jitney, set in a taxi company, followed by Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which was produced by the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center, where he met the director Lloyd Richards, who became his partner in drama, directed six of Wilson's plays. Wilson eventually wrote 10 plays called The Pittsburgh Cycle, each play taking place in a different decade. August Wilson, who said, "Confront the dark parts of yourself and work to banish them with illumination and forgiveness. Your willingness to wrestle with your demons will cause your angels to sing." On this date in 1667, the poet John Milton sold the copyright for Paradise Lost for £10. He had backed the wrong side in the English Civil War. He'd backed Cromwell against the king. And when the monarchy was restored, he was imprisoned, stripped of his property. He was impoverished and blind. It's the birthday of Mary Wollstonecraft, born London, 1759, whose book A Vindication of the Rights of Woman came out in 1792, one of the earliest books of feminist philosophy, in which she argues that it is lack of access to education, not any inherent flaw, that makes women seem inferior to men. And it's the birthday of Ludwig Bemelmans, born in Tyrol, Austria, 1898, who went to work in his uncle's hotel and got angry, shot, and almost killed a waiter. Left Austria, came to New York, started his own restaurant, became successful. And in 1939, he came out with a book, which began in an old house in Paris that was covered with vines, lived 12 little girls in two straight lines. The first of his Madeline books. Here's a poem for today, a sonnet by Shakespeare, his sonnet number 98. From you have I been absent in the spring, when proud pied April, dressed in all his trim, hath put a spirit of youth in everything, that heavy Saturn laughed and leaped with him, yet nor the lays of birds, nor the sweet smell of different flowers in odor and in hue could make me any summer's story tell, or from their proud lap pluck them where they grew. Nor did I wonder at the lily's white, nor praise the deep vermilion in the rose. They were but sweet, but figures of delight, drawn after you, you pattern of all those. Yet seemed it winter still, and you away, as with your shadow, I with these did play. Shakespeare's Sonnet 98, From You Have I Been Absent in the Spring. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. And by Lumosity.com, brain training developed by scientists to challenge memory and problem solving through online games. Lumosity.com. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 16 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned to Junior Afternoon. I'm Jeff Brown. I'm your host for today. In the studio with me is John Cooper. He's a facilities manager at the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute. He's here to talk about alternative energy and ways they use technology to save money. Thanks for coming to the station.
Oh, thank you, Jeff. Thanks for inviting me.
So you're the facilities manager at the NOAA facility here in town, and also for the Ted Stevens?
Yes, I'm the facility manager for the NOAA Fisheries facilities here in town. So we've got the facility next to the Coast Guard downtown, and then the old laboratory at Stater Harbor, and our newest laboratory, the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute, which is out at Lena Point.
We're talking to you today because one of our volunteers, Janet Grange, took a tour and gave me your card, and she said, you got to talk to this guy.
We've got a lot of stuff going on out there, that's for sure.
Can you give me an overview of it, please?
Well, the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute is a fisheries laboratory, so we've got scientists that are out there studying the biosphere, the fisheries biosphere, and studying salmon and groundfish, sable fish, out the Aleutian chain up into the Bering Sea. They're doing some really neat things fisheries-wise. I'm the facilities manager, and they've given me the license to do some really neat things with technology as well to try to help our environment out.
Now you use heat pumps there.
And we do. We use heat pumps. There's been a lot of things in the news recently about people doing heat pumps in Alaska, and I can say with all honesty that we were the first. We were the first to have a large water source heat pump in Alaska. We turned ours on in 2011 and have been using the seawater that's going through our lab to heat our building ever since.
How do you do that?
Well, with a heat pump's kind of like the refrigerator that you've got in your kitchen. In your refrigerator, you have the freezer compartment, and it's cold in there, and then it blows warm air out of the back, which comes out in the back of your kitchen. Well, in our situation, we've got the cold, which is the water that we're pulling the heat from, and we're pulling the heat out of that water, making that water a little bit colder, just like you do pulling the heat out of the food in your freezer, because you really can't make things cold. You can make things warm, but you can't make things cold. You can only take the heat away from them that's already there. So we take the heat out of the seawater, and then we put the heat into the building, and much in the same way that with your the coil on the back of your refrigerator, you're taking the heat out of your freezer and you're putting it into your kitchen. We're taking it out of the cold water and we're putting it into the building. And we've been doing that for 5 years now.
Does it save money?
It saves a lot of money. The efficiency of a heat pump is about three times that of heating water directly. So instead of spending money, we were using about 60,000 gallons of fuel a year, and if you multiply that by even $3 a gallon for fuel, which is less than we were paying a couple of years ago, that's over $180,000 that we were spending to heat the facility. Now we're spending about $36,000 to heat the facility. So it really is a huge savings in energy. And because our energy in Juneau is created with hydroelectric power, the energy that we are using does not have as much of a carbon footprint. So we are very carbon neutral in heating this facility.
Tell me about your use of LEDs.
Well, that's one of the other things we did. The parking lot lights that we have, they had your typical 400-watt sodium vapor, kind of an orangish light, which nobody really likes the orange light in the parking lot. It makes things kind of hard to see. And they used about 400 watts, and most of that was in heat. They got really hot. So we replaced those with 100-watt LED units, so we're saving... we're only using 25% of the energy. Those cost used four times as much energy as the ones that we're using now. And it's a brilliant white light. It's a really nice light to have in the parking lot. And like I said, we're saving that energy. In fact, the one problem that we've had, we have some lights that are under the sidewalk that were, just had a glass lens, and they were actually in the sidewalk pointing up at the flagpole. And when we put LEDs in there, we now have to shovel the snow off of the light in the winter because the LED doesn't create enough heat to melt the snow off of the top of the light.
Now, you're not in charge of this windmill here downtown next to the Coast Guard building, but you have a couple of your own.
I have a couple of my own. I have one sitting in the warehouse that's right beside the Coast Guard building, and then I've got one on St. Paul Island, a little bit larger than that one, and we're going to get that one installed. St. Paul Island, where they filmed The Deadliest Catch, we have a research facility there, and with the windmill out there, we should be able to provide about a third of the electricity that we use at that facility from the wind, and it blows a lot of wind out on St. Paul Island.
How come more businesses and government agencies aren't taking advantage of technology?
It's expensive. It's tough to make the jump into new technology. One of the things that the federal government does do is subsidize some of this technology and do take advantage of some of the innovations that are out there. We looked at how much we were spending and the technology that was out there, and were able to spend a little bit more when we purchased the technology, but now we're reaping the benefits, and we will continue to reap the benefits from here on out.
That's just about season for the tourists to come through there, and the locals to come and visit your facility.
Yes, once we open up for tours, we'll have tours each day at 1:30, I believe. The public can come by and see our facilities, and we have an individual there who does a really good job. We have a science on a sphere, which shows the globe and can show all kinds of different things about the sun and our planet in three dimensions so that you can really visualize what is happening.
What other kinds of examples of non-traditional thinking are there out there?
Well, one of the things that was just recently done, we're out on a point at Lena Point, and we don't have any fresh water other than the water that comes out of your tap. And so we're a fisheries research facility, and we wanted to do some research on Chinook salmon. So we started dechlorinizing water and circulating it like you would do in a household aquarium. And we actually have some freshwater salmon in our facility that we haven't been able to do. And this is something that we thought about. They're actually doing it up in Fairbanks. We're not the first here. They're doing it up at Fairbanks at one of the hatcheries up there that one of my maintenance mechanics helped to set up in Gordon Garcia helped set that one up in Fairbanks. And so he said, well, we can do it up there. We can do it down here. And so we're doing some research with freshwater salmon in a saltwater laboratory.
John Cooper, Facilities Manager for the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute and also the NOAA facility downtown and a variety of other places around Alaska. Thank you for coming in today and talking about it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Anything you want to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No, we're here for you. We care about the environment and we care about the community.
bassist Katie Theroux and friends. Katie's part of the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival this year.
Join the Foundation for End of Life Care for Return from Grief. This event is intended to give participants an opportunity to think about grief and to receive advice from four Juno experts. This moderated discussion will create a better understanding of how to approach a friend in grief, a better idea of what is helpful for someone in grief, and how to manage your own grief. This event is open to the public and takes place April 28th, 5:30 p.m. in the Hickel Room at Centennial Hall. Information at foundationforendoflifecare.org.
This is Bird Note. A high-pitched, tinkling bird song rings across an open landscape of short grasses. But strangely, there's no singer in sight. Oh, there's our bird, look up! A male-horned lark. It must be 100 feet in the air, hovering, wings fluttering, circling against the blue sky. Now the bird is gliding steeply, headlong towards the ground, flaring its wings at the last instant to break the dive. Horned larks, roughly the size of sparrows, rival meadowlarks as the most colorful birds of North American grasslands. The male's bright yellow face is framed by crisp black sideburns, and true to its name, the horned lark does have horns, of a sort. When in the mood, the male erects pointed black feathers above its eyes, giving it a devilish demeanor. Horned larks live in prairies, fields, and tundra. Agriculture and development now intrude on many of the horned larks' traditional nesting areas, so this once common bird has become one of conservation concern. Programs that replenish grasslands and set aside croplands can be a boon to this exquisite bird. Learn more and see a picture of a horned lark at our website, birdnote.org.
Hi, I'm Sarah Istoe.
And I'm Richard Stokes. We're sponsoring the Juno Poetry Broadside Show opening at the K2 Studio on the first Friday in May.
A poetry broadside is a collaboration between a poet and an artist. Broadsides are printed in small numbers and intended not only for display, but for public distribution.
The ones in this show are by Juno poets working with Juno artists, calligraphers, and photographers.
There will be a reception from 4:30 to 6:30. The broadsides will be on display at K2 throughout the month of May.
some of the music performed by the Third Coast Percussion Group. They're part of the Jazz and Classics Festival this year. If you need more information on that, go to jazzandclassics.org. In the studio with me now is Bernard Corey, architect. He's speaking at the Alaska Design Forum tonight at 6 o'clock in the 360 Studios. Bernard, thank you very much for being in the station with me today.
Thank you for the invitation.
Could you please describe for me what comes out of the Arab Center for Architecture?
The Arab Center for Architecture is a very interesting structure, the first of its kind in our part of the world. And what we try to do is to build a database and archive the works of the early moderns in our part of the world. Modern architecture is still not considered as part of history or historical, and we think that it's a very important period in our history, because our nations really took their independence at some point in the 40s and 50s, and this is when the first generation of local architects started building. This was a time when our countries had their attempted modernity. So I think it was a very important time in history for us, and unfortunately the general public does not really look at it very seriously.
What, if anything, defines Arab architecture?
I don't think we can define Arab architecture in any sort of consensual terms. You obviously have the clichés that you find now being perpetuated everywhere, the musharabi and these kinds of signs that are, I think, a dangerous simplification of history. Our societies are much more complex. The Arab world is extremely complex. It is in turmoil right now. And I think architecture has failed really to participate in the construction of meaning, really, any sort of political, social or cultural meaning at this point. I'm saying in general, in our part of the world.
Which one of your projects has been most satisfying to you and why?
That's a very difficult question, but your first love is something you that's always dear to you. I would say the first project was a big break for me, because after 16 failed attempts at building, 16 commissions that never made it to construction, I finally got to build my first project back in April of 1998 is when it started operating. And that was a very, very particular situation, because it's a project I built literally by myself without any building contractors, with very little money, a project I drew at night and I built during the day. It was very intense during a period of about 6 months. So I keep great memories of that. This was a time where I worked one project after the other, so I had a very intimate relationship with my projects. As you grow bigger, you start handling more projects at the same time. You become quicker, obviously. You become more experienced. So it becomes different as you grow.
You were influenced by your father.
Definitely, yes.
In what ways?
Maybe architecturally, but I think more importantly, my father was a very strong figure to me. Had a very particular career. He was an artist. He was an architect. He was an industrial. He was a teacher. He was a painter. He was a very good writer. So he did so many things, and I thought architecture could be like that. This was a time, I think, he was at his peak of his production in the 60s and 70s, back when I was a little kid in the 70s and 80s. So I looked at the profession with a very sort of romantic, idealized vision. Turns out the profession today is much different. So I keep the father figure with a sort of maybe kind of a romantic, idealistic, heroic attitude, and I try to keep up with that. It's very difficult. Very difficult. I think today the practice has become much, much different.
You've been called the bad boy of architecture in the Middle East. Why do you?
Yeah, I kind of I surfed that way for a while, and then I got sick of it, because it sticks to you. During the early years, I'd say the late 90s, early 2000s, I was imprisoned in this image, so people thought I could only do sensational architecture, problematic architecture, mainly in the entertainment industry. And developers, or more wise developers, thought that I wouldn't be capable of designing buildings in which people would grow families, because they thought I was not reasonable, and that's not true. So I think the last few years we've been doing very, very different works in terms of programs. So we've been doing a lot of residential work, and we've tried to prove that there can be a lot of pleasure in that too, and a lot of questioning and a lot of invention, hopefully.
You're speaking tonight at 6 o'clock downstairs in the At360 studios. What are you talking about tonight before the Alaska Design Forum?
I will be talking about my work, but hopefully not just about architecture and about context, but not necessarily in the most conventional ways. I will be talking about mainly about the people, the figures, the characters that I've crossed through my path the last 10, 15, 20 years, because it is through these people that I've defined every single time a context that was different and a different story. So it's more of a narrative and storytelling. Hopefully it'll be more about that than just purely the limited territory of architecture, which can be boring.
Hopefully it can be exciting at the same time.
Hopefully.
Bernard Corey, thank you so much for coming in. You'll be talking tonight at 6 o'clock downstairs in the At360 studios. Evelyn, what is the price to get in?
$15.
All right. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
It's great to come to Alaska.
Is this your first time?
It's the first time, yeah.
Cool. Thanks. Welcome to Alaska.
Thanks.
And you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. Our next guest in the studio is Margie Hamburger from the Juno Douglas City Museum. Thanks for coming in, Margie.
Yeah, thanks for fitting me in.
You got a lot of stuff going on.
I got a couple of things going on. Yeah, we're going to do these, I don't know, a lot of people have heard about Joseph Alexander, the photographer who had a studio here for about 40 years, commercial photographer. And we've got this ginormous collection, and we've been doing all kinds of things to try and identify a lot of the faces that we don't have names for. So over the next 3 days, starting tomorrow, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, there's going to be thousands, literally thousands of these images out on tables available for folks to hopefully, if anyone who's lived in Juneau in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s when his studio was open and might have a little bit of time to come by and paw through these photos and see if they can help us put names to faces. We'd love them to do that.
Thousands of photos.
Thousands, like 5,000, something like that. I don't know if we'll have them all out, but we'll have a lot of them out. And we've got a couple of events around that. The collection is available online, so if people like to sit at home and look at all these photos, they can. And tomorrow, Thursday at noon, at the lunch hour from noon to 1, if anyone wants to stop by, we'll have some computers up and a knowledgeable volunteer who can show people how to access that online. It's somewhat intuitive if you're familiar with our website, but if you want a little help to figure that out, that's going on. And then on Saturday, Sharon Gateman and Peter Freer are going to be around in the morning at 10:30, for about an hour, hour and a half. We're going to have some coffee and, again, encourage people to come by and look at the photos and also just kind of have a talking circle, again, from people who are around in those times. Maybe they had their photo taken by Mr. Alexander, their high school photo or a family photo, a wedding photo, and just kind of reminisce about all of that. So that's another event. But as I said, all the photos are going to be out all day. We're open from 10 to 4 on those days, and love for people to stop by who think they might be able to recognize somebody.
When do your summer hours start?
Our summer hours start on May 2nd, and that's also when we start charging admission, so people should come by here if they want to get in. But we will have First Friday on May 6th, be our last First Friday of the season until the fall, and so that's another opportunity on First Friday. And I just also want to squeeze in a couple other things. The other thing that happens in the summer is we have walking tours throughout the summer, and generally those are during the day, which works well for our tourists, but we're having a couple of special ones in the evening targeting locals who maybe can't come in the day. And the first is going to be May 4th, and that's going to be our local hero walking tour that evening at 5:30. And the following week on May 12th, we'll have our other walking tour, which is our downtown historic tour. And that's also starting at 5:30, and people can call us up or go to the website and register for those events or any of the ones throughout the whole summer season. They're in the afternoons, though, during the summertime.
And the museum is a great place to take visitors.
It is a great place to take visitors. You know, it fits really nicely. People can probably, about an hour, hour and a half, watch our movie, see the exhibits. Admission is $6 or $5 for seniors and free for kids 12 and under. And it can be a fun place for all kinds of ages and, really dives into the story of Juno. So it is a great place to bring visitors.
Marcia Hamburger, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
About 12 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned to Juno Afternoon. Our next guest in the studio comes to us from the Canvas Community Arts Studio, Brian Braley. Thank you so much for coming down to the station.
Thanks for having me.
So you got a lot of stuff going on at the Canvas.
We have so much stuff going on right now. We started our summer kids classes. We're doing registration for that right now, and the classes are going pretty quickly. We've got about 24 classes this summer going from June to August. They're all week-long classes. We got them in the morning, afternoon, so if you want the 9 to 12 crowd, and then after that's 1 to 4. There's everything from painting, ceramics, we've got jewelry making. We've got a couple of visiting artists this year. Marie Doomgard from, we're in Juneau, she's from Fairbanks, she's up at UAF. And she'll be doing some mask making and paper mache puppets for a couple of the classes. We've got local weaver Ricky Tagabon, who's doing thigh spinning, which is a kind of a method of making yarn using raw materials. And some of our local artists are also doing some classes. We've got Mercedes, who's she's our ceramics manager in the studio there. And Emma is our visiting artist, who's also doing some classes like felt critters for kids. We just did a couple of adult classes for that, which were pretty successful. And parents can call me up at the Canvas. My number there is 586-1750, and definitely go online to canvasarts.org, and that's another way to sign up.
You've got a lot of different programs around for the summer. When do they start? again?
The summer, the kids programs, the first classes start on June 6th, and they wrap up on August 12th. And again, anybody can register for just a week or the entire series, any combination. We also have some adult classes coming up next month in May, which is just next week. On Tuesdays in May, we have wheel throwing classes with Mercedes Minos. That's every Tuesday at 5:30. And on Thursdays, we're doing a plein air watercolor painting class. So we'll be going around town in different places, which is a great time to do it now that everything's turning flowers and green leaves. That's with Avril Veliz. So again, those can be registered online at canvasarts.org.
What's your background?
My background? I work in design and marketing mostly. I'm kind of doing a little bit of everything at the Canvas right now. But I just moved to Juneau a few weeks ago, so they've kind of thrown me into the radio world already representing. So don't ask any hard-hitting questions here.
Where are you from?
Kodiak, originally. I worked for the Aleutic Museum there the past couple of years. So it's kind of a similar but different transition over here, working with the Canvas. It's a great group. And our first Friday is coming up next week. We have Grace Conrad for May. She's our featured artist. She's been with the Canvas working in our day hab for the past 8 years? Since 2008? Is that 8?
Don't give me the tough questions.
Math, hard questions, all this. Come check that out. It's her first solo show. She's done several group shows here in Juneau and around. This will be her first one-woman solo show, so that's pretty exciting. That'll be on May 6th at 4:30 to 7.
Cool. Got a lot of stuff going on, as usual. It's a great place.
Yeah, check out our Facebook for all the updated stuff. I'll be the one kind of manning that for now. It's been kind of sedate for a bit, so check online. Social media is going to go crazy with the Canvas soon.
Where is it located?
The Canvas, we are downtown at 223 Seward Street. So we're in the Reach building, which people might be familiar with.
All right, Brian, really, thank you for coming down. Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
I'm sorry, Liz?
Is there anything?
Just check us out on social media. We've got so much. George Gress is going to be taking his guitars down at this weekend. He's been our featured artist this past month, so he has all these handmade guitars.
They're beautiful.
Oh, you saw them. They are amazing. A lot of them are collaborations with local artists, which is kind of cool. So there's like a local carver that helped with one. All the wood has been sourced by people he knows around town, and it's pretty amazing. So definitely come check that out. It'll be up till Friday evening this week.
All right. Brian, thanks for coming down.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, located at 1619 Glacier Avenue in downtown Juneau, offering aqua aerobics on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. until 12 p.m., and stretch aquatics on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. until 11:45 a.m. Schedules are available online at juneau.org/parkrec/pool. More information at 586-5325.
Well, the forecast for tonight, scattered rain showers in the evening, then rain likely later on. Low temperatures around 42 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, rain likely with high temperatures around 47 degrees. Friday, rain likely with high temperatures around 50 degrees.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3.